This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Ian Sinclair returns to the show to talk about a day's walk around the Ginger Line in London Overground, and also about the monograph Black Apples of Gower. Ian Sinclair is a poet, filmmaker, essayist, and the author of many acclaimed books, including Downriver, which won the James Tait Black Memorial Prize, Lights Out for the Territory, London Orbital, Edge of the Horizon, Hackney, That Rose Red Empire, which we've talked about in a previous Little Atoms, Dining on Stones, Ghost Milk, American Smoke. He's the editor of the anthology London, City of Disappearances, and he's also written and presented a number of films for BBC Two's Late Show, collaborated with Andrew Cotting on Swan Down and By Ourselves, and co-directed several documentaries with Chris Pettit, including London Orbital and The Falconer. He was born in South Wales, went to school in England and university in Ireland, and he now lives in Hackney. In this interview, we're going to talk about two new books, London Overground and Black Apples of Gower. So, Ian, it's a pleasure to talk to you, first of all.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you again. It's curious how old I am, because 5 years has been the blink of an eye. It felt like yesterday.
So it was 5 years ago that we talked about Hackney, That Rose Red Empire.
And it's still here.
It is.
More
just
or less.
About. Although even more changed than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's a totally new place now. It is a kind of model paradigm of the city of the future. I mean, it's as much virtual as actual. It's a mysterious event to move across the streets of Hackney. There's a whole new demographic, and even the very geography seems to have changed. You know, places like Broadway Market have imported a slice of Notting Hill or Borough Market in the terms of the food market. You know, instead of Hackney being a place where people move to escape from Whitechapel or a sort of staging post out of their various ghettos, it's now somewhere to aspire to. It's incredibly expensive.
You know? Yeah, and indeed, I could not ever imagine living here.
No, you know, we moved to where we're sitting was a small terraced house was actually condemned in the late 1960s. They wanted to get rid of all these things, and nobody could be persuaded to move into them. They were phenomenally cheap. Now we have High Court judges, you know, we have Will Young, we have millionaires all around us, and the people are frightened to stay. They kind of feel they must move out because their houses are worth millions.
The thing that was looming on the horizon when we last spoke was the Olympics, and we talked a lot about the development that was going on around the Olympics, and you're sort of one of the most perceptive observers about the change in, you know, not just the, you know, the development, but obviously the sort of demographic of the people that were living around and being displaced by that. So what happened? That's what I want to talk about, really, first of all. So the Olympics came and went.
Yeah.
And there was this, you know, the legacy, which I'm doing in inverted commas, which people call.
Well, they worked through the legacy before it happened. The legacy was a big debate before it happened. Then there was this flash frame, which was all bells and whistles, an incredible blitz of light that lasted a few moments with compulsory wall-to-wall TV and national celebration, money pumped in, medals, and then what happens afterwards is pretty weird. It's a strange landscape now. Nobody quite knows what it is. You've created this park, but it's more like a retail park than a pleasure park. It looks like it belongs on the edge of a city with a highway going through it, heading to the big Westfield Centre, which is really the germinator of the whole process. I mean, everything really belonged to a huge shopping mall with some attached fun and games for a few weeks. And then the whole business of giving the stadium over to West Ham Football Club is a pretty strange and weird affair.
Well, even that as a transport hub now, I used, only a couple of weeks ago, used the Stratford International. I come through Stratford all the time, but used the Stratford International Station for the first time. And the approach to that was, you know, you had to get walk from, through the shopping
you
centre.
You have to come through the shopping centre. So the
first time I'd ever been into Westfield.
It's pedestrian permeability, which means that there's only certain ways you can walk, and those ways take you past all the outlets in Westfield. I mean, that is the kind of the model, and then the buildings that grow up are essentially parasitical on this, and the owners are often offshore or investors of some sort. They come in and you're disposing of the people whose natural habitat it was. And I've noticed that some of the very first flats that went up around the time we were chatting, where they were putting up the first flats that would operate in this landscape, are now already being taken down for bigger ones. They didn't really work, and the people in there are finding that the lifts don't work. There are people getting ill, very high percentage of people getting ill from the dust that was coming off the site. Nobody ever addressed the fact that it was carcinogenic, and there was so much radioactive material buried, and the river was dead. All of those kind of things were totally brushed aside. We can't see really yet exactly what will become of it. When you have such an imperative towards making it work, as with Docklands, it does achieve something like a success, inverted commas, because people come there, money comes there, especially, you know, you end up basically with banks, big bank towers, and the same thing is happening with the Olympic area in Stratford, in that they're now parachuting in a whole series of people who have no choice to be there.
The number of towers around there, the developments, towers of housing, is incredible. They just seem to sprout up every day.
Yeah, it's a computer-generated city that's actually slipped off the screen onto the landscape of London for a time. But the more you talk to people who actually live there or live nearby, they're generally fairly uneasy, unless they've bought into this and just come along now.
So there's a place here. I've just walked down Kingsland High Road and over, like, actually, you know, a relatively attractive development over the top of Dalston Junction, but just looks like, you know, completely out of place, totally in the wrong place.
Well, it's a generic development. I mean, it could be literally anywhere. I mean, what happens is that you've abolished the whole idea of suburb, inner city, outer city is gone, in that these kind of suburban developments are now happening in the city, and gradual leaching away of the local, because the thing that made London great, as far as I was concerned, was that all these small localities were all very different. They all had very different qualities, and they were like a series of small villages, settlements, industrial operations that happened to bump into each other and argue with each other and give you the flavour of what a city was. But now there's a more and more an impulse to make them all the same. If you're standing in Dalston Junction, you literally could be anywhere.
Although it does still have, that's why one of the reasons why it seems like so incongruous.
Well, bits of the old, of course. Yeah. There's a peace mural, and there's traces of the old street. But the great Victorian theatre that was there was demolished to create that thing that you're looking at. And it was done to create the transport hub. I mean, that whenever you see the word hub, you have to be very, very wary. And there's a lot of pressure on the great treasure of the area, which is Ridley Road Market, big street market, very democratic market. It's uncontrollable, so they want to kind of bring that down to a controllable level and replace it with a big supermarket. And they've already shot Kingsland Waste Market, which if you walk down Kingsland Road to here on a Saturday, that would have been a big market when I first lived here, and that's now to all intents and purposes disappeared because the council don't like it. It's untidy, makes rubbish, and you never know what's being sold there, and they don't like that. Whereas Broadway Market is this sort of very controllable space with expensive food and little bistros and bars and hairdressers, and there it goes. It's a different London.
Who's coming in then? Who's buying those flats?
Young people, often with both couples working, high income in IT and fashion and music and all that kind of general area, or else people who've got wealthy parents who've set them up there, because the costs are phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean that seems more like it. I mean, young people. The descriptor there of young people.
They're not the same young people. There were young people when when we moved in. There were young people, but they mostly didn't have any money, and they were forming communal houses with large groups of people who lived in houses and carried out various projects, political or artistic or whatever. And they were here because it was a totally run-down area in the way that's always happened. And then artists come in, and then the state agents see what's happening because the area is getting different and so on and so on. This, I've actually heard people talking who don't really know where they are. They just know that this is the happening thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an extension of what started down in Brick Lane. Brick Lane, Hoxton, Old Street creates Silicon Roundabout and the kind of nightlife scene. And now, it's spilled up Kingston Road, and for various reasons that we'll probably come into later, I think that's changed everything. In that the kind of buildings that are being built have transport connections that make it possible for you to come and be here in a way that you couldn't in the old Hackney, because there was no underground connection, it sort of remained off the map. It remained interestingly peculiar, and that's under threat. So you're going to end up with a whole bunch of glistening new buildings, parasitical either on the canal or on the railway system.
I think, superficially, you could come here, walk around and suggest that things were similar to that, the Brick Lane of the 80s and early 90s, you suggest, artists coming in, taking over places, doing interesting things. Then you look a bit closer and it's cafes selling breakfast cereals and cat cafes and things rather than actual artists.
It's still an interesting mix, because you've always had so many different cultures coming here, so you don't have to pick away very hard at it till you see the stretches that are Afro-Caribbean, the stretches that are Turkish, Kurdish, Vietnamese. They're all here. They're all still thriving and flourishing, but it's got this hipstery overlay that likes that general atmosphere. It probably doesn't use that part of it very much. And they, there are people, I would imagine, who barely eat anything in their own flats or living spaces at all. They're perpetually in this thing of going to work on the state-of-the-art bicycles, and they come through and have a designer coffee from an artisan baker, and that's your hit for the day. And you're already plugged into the electronic world. You can hear this yapping going on as they come down the road, because they're already in the office before they've got there, or else taking care of business for the day. So it's like a flock of birds jabbering and screeching as they come down the street, and then it clears and it's quiet for a bit.
Bred from an artisan baker that no one that would ever have generally called themselves an artisan could ever.
Now, artisan baker means that you're basically a downsizing city banker who's taken your redundancy money and you fancy dabbling in playing at a baker or butcher for a bit in the outfit. And people like that feel. They like to think they're buying some kind of peasant food, but even though it's costing them seven times as much as what they could get from the old established bakers that are still around.
And, you touch on this in the book on London Overground that we're going to get onto in a moment, but these sort of new developments, we're talking about these, the buildings of towers, they sort of come in and they superficially attempt, they give themselves a nice sort of twee name, and they attempt to try and take on a little bit of the flavour of the locality.
Well, they generally have a flavour of locality that the locality never had. They call themselves city mills. Well, it's not in the city, and it was never a mill. Well, they'll give you something like that, try and reference something that was not there. So you're imposing a bogus narrative on history, and you're trying to sanitise a lot of the darkness of the industrial age that's gone before and wipe it out and not deal in that.
I'm Emma-Jane Unsworth, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's move on to London Overground then, and you've already touched on this. The train line that we're going to talk about in this book is one of the things that's opened up this area and plenty others.
Sure, yeah, totally. The whole process with writing London Overground was essentially, I'd written so much about all of that Olympic argument and privatisation of public space, loss of public space, the enclosures, the driving away of communities, travellers, the ending of allotments, all of that stuff. So I really felt beaten down by that whole argument, and I didn't really want to walk into the areas I'd been walking into for so long as a memory ground. I had to strike off in a totally different direction just to see what had happened. So in walking down towards the river, basically to Shoreditch and down that way, I kind of noticed that the dominant thing was the sound of this new, quotes, railway that was sighing and moaning orgasmically alongside me. And then I remembered it isn't actually a new railway at all. It was always there. We used to be able to get a train from Dalston Junction, where we've talked about this block of flats, down to the city for city clerks to go to work. And it was closed down in the Thatcher era. It lasted till then. There's no demand for a train anymore. And she said, people who use public transport are losers if they're over 20. All that sort of madness. So this goes. But really, so you could create Broadgate development in the city, which is all phony ice rinks and New York pastiche and artworks and so on. Now, of course, in the Olympic moment, the idea is to bring it back because you've got to have connections to Stratford and so on. So they pick up on the old railway, which had become a kind of derelict wilderness zone, a real green bridge with trees growing up, people hiding out on it, all sorts of stuff. And it was reconnected and became part of this necklace of railway, that one part of which was completely circular. So in a sense, you could, in the way that I'd walked around the M25 before, I realised now I could walk down to the river, go pick it up on Rotherhithe, go right through Peckham and Denmark Hill and Clapham and all these places I didn't know very well, come back over the river again and up through Chelsea Harbour, Shepherd's Bush, Willesden, back into Finchley, Hampstead, over the hill, back, literally come round the entire circuit of the city in a day. Mm-hmm. And so places you didn't think of connected with places that had never been connected before, and it had a rich cultural backstory in it. And I thought, well, if I walked around the M25 as describing a particular period, essentially, of abolishing the strength of the inner city, closing down the GLC, opening up the financial markets, opening up this road, connecting up to retail parks, abolishing the hospitals and asylums that were around the edge and turning them into private gated communities, then now very much the same thing would happen right in the inner city. And that was really interesting. And then I thought that the railway itself created a microclimate, that the railway really was a kind of London, and that if you were not on the railway, you were not part of the story. And so they built flats, balconies were inches from, literally inches from the line. All of these had bicycles on, and below, all of those strange railway arches were filling up with coffee bars, dance studios, Japanese restaurants, whatever. So here we are, here's London, completely altered by the fact of this old thing being promoted and established. And so I thought, well, let's do it. And the interesting way to do it to me was where I'd walked around the M25 in 12 different walks, one day a month for a year. Let's try and do this in a single day. And I persuaded Andrew Cotting, who had made the Swan Down film, to come with me. And we started off in Haggerston, and we walked right around the whole of this London circuit in a single day. So it's a very simple story, but a good way of reading the temperature of what's going on at the moment.
The way he describes the M25 in London Orbital, as you said, sort of that sort of, like, you know, big Thatcherite project, sort of almost, you know, encircling a noose around London, the closing down of the outside. I mean, actually, I think this, not necessarily what you talk about in the book, but the project itself is a lot more optimistic. There's a lot more, you know, the idea of freedom by the opening and the encircling of London by this train line.
Well, there's a lot of, initially, it felt good because it was efficient service.
It works. It's really good.
It works. The trains come every few minutes. They're bigger and there's more light and air than in the tube system. And secondly, there are these random connections. Like, I can now go to New Cross. I've got to go to Goldsmiths. It's not a huge hassle.
Yeah.
Or I'm very happy to go to see an old lady who I interviewed for the last book who lived in Denmark Hill. So this is, I mean, really, it opened up a kind of easygoing version of London, in a sense, because you just get on this thing and it goes there. But there are other sides to it too, that, you know, I saw that property values leapt in some bits and then tumbled in others, and that when you got to Clapham, I met this woman who was very incensed because there had been an old train that went directly to Victoria Station, where she wanted to go in 5 minutes. Now she was committed to do some long digressive loop on this thing, which had replaced it because that was the sexy development of the moment, and they got rid of all the old stuff.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Ian Sinclair. We're talking at the moment about his book London Overground, A Day's Walk Around the Ginger Line. We'll soon be talking about his book Black Apples of Gower. But Ian, in the first part you described actually the history of, there was a history to the stretch of reopened Overground Railway. But you also have, you have a history with other parts of the railway as well, and I do as well. I've lived out of London for 8 years, but lived in London 15 years previously to that. And when I first came here, I lived over in Kensal Green, worked over near Gunnersbury, and so every day would use that line. But also like the other way, because that other way opened up to me Hampstead Heath and Camden Town and Islington. Now, subsequently moved out to Essex, I come into the city that way and use that line again a lot to go to Hackney, to go to Stoke Newington. And, you know, the opening up, as you've said, the opening up to the south, I have friends in Crystal Palace, so I recently went to visit on that line as well. It's almost like, I almost feel like there's so much, there's no need to go into the West End. You know, there's so much of London that opens up on that line.
That's probably one of the effects it's going to have. Mm-hmm. Combined with what happened in setting up Westfield, which has become a great magnet for people who you wouldn't think would do it, but they say, oh, it's easy to park. Mm-hmm. So the West End must be losing out to this, and equally the Westfield on the other side in Shepherd's Bush, mm-hmm. because this railway walk takes you right up to the Shepherd's Bush one as well, and you see that those are the destinations now, not any particular place or cultural setting or anything else. And essentially there's a threat that the centre is going to change dramatically. Mm-hmm. We already see that Chelsea and Kensington are literally emptying out, that there are just these striking looking properties that belong to people who don't live there. They're just doing it as an investment, and it's going to be one of the biggest changes that London has had for a very long time. Because initially what happens is, you know, the founding city is down behind us on the river there. There is this walled city that is the founding place. And then Westminster becomes the seat of government, and there's a really dubious walk between the two, as Samuel Pepys writes about this muddy, dangerous stretch, or you go by river. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And then gradually the various suburbs come into play, and you've built up this necklace around London. Well, now we're actually literally challenging that in interesting ways. We're saying that the middle is going to be hopeless. We're just going to dig an enormous Crossrail tunnel, and you're going to be coming out to these bits on the edge, and that, so the edge is not edge anymore, and the middle is not middle, and the geometry of it all is becoming really interestingly peculiar.
So tell us some of your history with that, with what was the North London line.
Well, I mean, initially, I when I came to London from Wales, I was living down in South London. I was going to a film school in Electric Avenue in Brixton, which we walked past on this. Though there's no rail stop in Brixton, I think they decided Brixton is too dangerous or something. They don't stop there. And then my whole early learning version of London was I understood the Northern line, you know, or I just used to go up and down that, because it went to Charing Cross Road, where bookshops were, and I'd meet people in Soho, whatever. You go up to Hampstead to the Everyman Cinema. Mm-hmm. Or I literally kind of stuck to the Northern Line,
because
I knew I didn't branch out. And I remember the first time I branched out to come up to Dalston, I needed to come up to the Rio Cinema up here. It was a real adventure, you know, coming to Liverpool Street and then getting a bus, because basically you had to get a bus from there. There was no way of continuing the railway journey. And I think that's how people learn their London. They have some interest, specific interest, or connections, family or friends that take them to places, and then they learn one small part of what's the convenient transport network, and that becomes their vision, until maybe they start walking or cycling across the entire map, and London changes for them. Mm-hmm.
No, and that was very much what it was like for me, in that I lived in London for 15 years, but I have almost no conception of the bus routes. I never really used the bus. I have, you know, learned, I know how to get everywhere on the tube, but also that North London rail network as well is like very deeply imprinted. But yeah,
the old days was this really eccentric rail network that ran from Woolwich, North Woolwich, around to Kew, really disconnected places, but it was a fantastic kind of magical journey.
Yeah.
The train itself was pretty clapped out by the end. It was horribly crowded on certain stretches, all the
school kids were using it to fight your way on it, but it, you know, really was just an adventure to come from here. I used to go to Camden Town an awful lot on that because of Compendium Bookshop, this independent bookshop, which was a big centre. Or else, you know, round to Kew Gardens in Richmond just for a day out in somewhere different, see a different part of the river.
It's funny you mentioned now, and I think it's particularly either Hackney Central or it might have been Dalston. You get out and there is like flats, like literally right overlooking the platform. When I lived up in Kensal Green, I lived overlooking Kensal Rise station on that line, which was very convenient for going to work in the morning. But at night, the trains would stop and that route would be given over to goods trains. And I would like lie in bed, which overlooked the railway line, and these 10-minute long trains would go by. Well, and the bed would vibrate like I was in some cheap
trains
motel.
Used to go through as well.
Yeah, yeah, that, apparently waste.
So, yeah, all kinds of stuff went along. But one of the people I write about in the book is the painter Leon Kossoff, who I think had an sort of exemplary railway visionary career.
Yeah.
Because he grew up down in Whitechapel and then got a studio in Dalston. But it was right on the railway line, right at the junction. So he could look into Ridley Road Market one way and he looked at the German hospital the other way. Mm. Did these huge paintings in the 70s of the changing landscape as people began to build around there. And then he moves to Willesden and he's doing huge oceanic pictures of all the railway lines at Willesden Junction. He's got a studio there and he's now moved across to Willesden Green and is doing kind of very interesting paintings that are just the end of his garden with a cherry tree drooping over and the trains flashing past and the realisation that people on the trains are looking in at him. And that's like a whole London life described by means of the railway.
I want to talk about the walk then. So you've already mentioned you had a companion filmmaker, Andrew Cotting. So, I'll let you describe him.
Well, Andrew is quite a eccentric, extremely energetic character. He began as a physical performer, sort of comedian. Mm-hmm. He's a big, big, strong guy. And from that point, he was also a market trader and he lived in Deptford, and so it was very useful to me in terms of this book that he was able to describe that part of London from personal memory. And one of the people he met in that era, Philip Jenkinson, who was a film reviewer on television and had a private collection of films, and he used to show these films to Andrew and his family and various other people in his house. When Andrew had come there as a painter and decorator and got to know him, he then encouraged Andrew to make short films. So they were like films in the tradition of the sort of goon-type films and Dick Lester. These were absurdist films, very physical, lots of running about in industrial deadlands. And from there it evolved to the point he did his most famous film, I guess, would be Gallivant. Is a film where he takes a camper van round the whole of the coast of Britain with his old granny and his young daughter who suffers from Joubert's syndrome. And it was amazingly affectionate portrait of these two, and also a kind of mad travelogue of the whole of Britain. So I knew him and his energies, and we used to both spend time in Hastings, so he lives in St Leonard's now, and I see him down there a lot, and started to do various projects together, particularly one of taking a swan pedalo from Hastings all the way back to Hackney at the pre-Olympic moment. We took it all by water. And so after that I said to him, you know, I'm going to do this walk around London a single day, do you want to come along? Luckily he did, because it was a way of discussing a film we wanted to do about the poet John Clare escaping from Epping Forest to go back to his home village. So essentially we were kind of talking about that and accessing the stories of his territory that he remembered, and me telling him stuff basically through the East End as we got down to the river. And then we passed into bits that neither of us knew particularly well, so that was interesting and mysterious. Then we come back into bits that one or other of us know again. And the nice thing is it goes right through the day into the night with stops for meals and eccentric cafes and lots of banter and chat. And he's doing it almost like a performance. He's got a funny suit.
Yeah, he turns up in a rather interesting outfit.
Yeah, strange suit. His wife, Layla, makes his clothes for him for these films and performances. She made a kind of slightly Joseph Boyce-like feltish suit, very heavy, very thick, would have stood up to anything. A bit hot for it, I mean, even though it was done in, I can't remember, it was in February, I think it was in a winter walk anyway. It got really, really hot, and he's he's carrying kind of strange things like a stuffed monkey, and picks up, constantly picking up books along the way and getting me to write in them and then placing them somewhere else, particularly in Kensal Green, where there was this library protest and there's a library on the pavement, and he gets stuff this book into this collection of books so it's left up there somewhere. Those sort of things. So in a way, he was the ideal companion, because he's full of this sort of physical performance and also always engaging in conversations with people in amusing ways, and that left me free to...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Observe.
And also, he's you can write what you like, because as you mentioned numerous times, he's not likely to read it.
You did read it quite carefully. Yeah, as long as it's about him, he'll read it. He skips the other bits that aren't about him.
I'm David Stubbs. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So, I mean, you often have a companion on a walk,
yes,
like that. So does that... Oh, you just described that, you know, he can be doing the performance, you
sure,
can observe.
Sure, I mean, the thing is about this walk is it's not simply... It's not a guidebook.
No, absolutely,
it's not a sort of a pure documentary. It's like making a construction, almost like a novel.
Yeah.
So like Don Quixote or something, the form of having the straight man and the comic character is a classic. And I think there's a thing about when two people are walking, it's not like we're talking now face to face, but you're side by side and your eyes are looking out, making a span of the horizon. And that encourages a sort of different kind of confessional talk and storytelling that seems to suit the form of a walk, and you need to have the person. It makes it a different experience to a solitary walker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the solitary walker form's got a classic tradition as well. Writers like W.G. Sebald are essentially on their own, walking in a melancholy meditation about landscape, which this isn't. This is to do with teasing out a kind of knockabout comedy and then serious moments, and then allows me to digress into memories of somebody like Angela Carter or J.G. Ballard, you know, which are people Andrew Cotting didn't know much about or had never met, and I could tell him about them, and I could also come back and investigate it, write about it later.
And we'll get onto those in a moment. But I wanted to ask, I mean, first of all, especially with something like this, where you've set yourself a nominal route, which obviously
it's a very fixed route.
But what I mean is, there's going to be, you know, logistical probably there's an issue about how you cross the river,
yes,
for instance,
yes,
and things. You obviously can't walk on the railway line. You've got to sort of follow the railway line as well as you can. But you've also imposed this idea of doing it all in the day.
Yeah, we do it all in the day, and we have to take a photograph at each station, which we miss one because we're talking too much. At Peckham Rye, we actually walk right past the station, which was really annoying because we've done every station day and night. So then I felt I had to go back, you know, almost the next day and take a selfie of that one to sort of put that one in the collection.
To what extent, I was going to ask, do you, how well planned is that?
Not at all. I mean, it's planned, and the whole thing is planned in the sense that I'd already done it on my own. I did it as three different walks, and I looked at things in some detail as I went round, quietly in my own time, and I took a bunch of photographs. Yeah. So I knew the whole span of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that set it up. So that was a rehearsal for the day with him. I didn't have to slow down to look at things in the same way as I'd done when I walked on my own. So it's not quite as sort of free form as it would appear in the book. I tried to give it the impression
of
spontaneity in the book. Well, here we are going around. But I've actually done it all already. And indeed returned to places like Chelsea Harbour after we'd finished, because we didn't have time to look at it in enough detail as we walked.
Well, I think, I mean, you've already there answered the next question I was going to ask, which is obviously, you know, this is not just a walk, you're writing a book about it.
So
The whole thing is essentially a book,
and I've decided that this material would lend itself to a book. I want to write the book, and it's a book, yet another book about London. It's about a particular moment in London, and you know, as we already discussed, that I think a changing London, and this is like a corridor that allows you to see a glimpse of this changing London, which I think is going to be to do with literally almost a tunnel, a microclimate around transport systems. We're now working on Crossrail. And when Crossrail was first planned, there were people buying up properties in places that were projected where this would go. And you can see the effect that massive property rises are coming on the back of future transport networks. And I think what will happen is the black spots where there really aren't the transport networks anymore. And I've noticed already in parts of North London, like Enfield, there's a huge rise in crime. And they're trying to, I think, bring that into the overground system as time goes on.
You've already mentioned a couple of times the literary references as you're going around this walk, and places that people are associated with. So William Blake in Peckham Rye, and Ballard in Chelsea Harbour, as you said, Angela Carter in Clapham Junction. So, yeah, I wanted you just to tell us a couple of bits about some of this.
Yeah, the major literary ones are really the people you mentioned. Mm. William Blake is always a presence in any London journey, because his whole take on London is to convert it into a mythical system. He was a major walker. He's walking in his own old age from the river, Fountain Court by the Strand. He walks up to Hampstead, where he sees his family, and walks back when he's well in his 60s, which was old then. And he remembers his childhood walks out to Peckham Rye and his first visions of angels. And he's married in St Mary's Church, which we passed by in this walk, just at the point where we crossed the river. So he's with it all the sort of time, like a kind of companion presence. But the fixed presences in this were really Angela Carter, because she was so supportive to when I was starting to write fiction. I didn't know her for a very long period, but I just thought her take on London was great. It was a take into this old London of music hall stars and old ladies behaving badly, and memories of kind of all the smells and dirt and movement and old railway stations of London. All that was in her work, which I liked, and the fact that she was so resolutely South Londoner and felt uncomfortable when she was in places like Whitechapel. And she wrote a very nice piece on my book Downriver, which starts with about saying how strange she found it and how alien and even frightened she felt when she stepped onto those streets, because it was just not a London she knew. So I wanted to give some account of her, and I think her trajectory was between that part and Notting Hill, where she was part of that kind of 60s New Worlds, Michael Moorcock, Ballard, that moment.
And Ballard, I mean...
And Ballard himself, obviously, is famously a person of the edge.
Yeah.
He lived out in Shepperton for many years. And his version of London centre is slightly fantastic. This late book, which uses a set very like Chelsea Harbour, is really kind of an imaginary construct based on some of his memories from when he did live in the centre in the 60s, and then again from stuff he's read. So it creates this quite curious sort of cartoony version of the city, which is actually quite true to what it really is, because it is like a quite strange cartoony version of itself. And it was an attempt to impose one of these upmarket communities on a place that didn't really suit it initially. It was these are old coal yards and power stations, and all that stuff is suddenly thrown up into towers, and it's not part of its own territory. So you create a very weird atmosphere, and that's the atmosphere he taps into. He's fascinated by the paranoia of the established middle classes and the underlying ennui and boredom that forces them to behave in peculiar ways and become almost urban terrorists.
Ballard's a big influence on all of your work, I think, but I felt it particularly a few times in this book, how it starts with there's a dead pigeon at the beginning. There was a line, I mean, seriously, I almost put the book down and applauded. There was a line that when you're at Millwall, where you describe a blue sky fit enough for a fatal Florida rocket launch or something.
Yeah. Which it was just like Cape Canaveral, yeah. It was exactly like that. It was like the day of something that you're going to watch with horror. The sky is too blue and it's going to blow itself to pieces. It had that atmosphere, yeah, absolutely. That was a very Ballardian image. I didn't think of it at the time, but you're right. But, I mean, I wasn't, it's, my main point of influence and contact with him was at the time of doing the London Orbital thing, because obviously the whole corridor out there on that side was seen through his prism. But before that, really, I suppose, I don't think I was particularly influenced by him, because the things I was interested in were not things he was interested in at all. That London Gothic. Mm-hmm. The old carbonised, dirty London with the patinas and the levels beneath it. He's not interested really in digging into these multi-layered versions of London like sort of Peter Ackroyd or something. He's interested in this pristine surface and the way that the people who move into those pristine surfaces are affected by them.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to Ian Sinclair. We've been talking about his book London Overground, and now we're going to talk about his book Black Apples of Gower, which is something of a departure. How did this come about? What's the idea behind this
book? The Black Apples of Gower book would seem to be a departure. It was come from Independence Press called Little Toller, who's I'd seen their books around. They were very nice books.
It's a very attractive
book. My contact with them was not so far away, because they published a book by Richard Mabey about edgelands. It was one of the definitive books on the whole idea of edgelands, published before the fashion, long before the fashion in the 70s. And they were going to reissue this book, which is about those bits on the edges of cities, liminal territories where industries are rotting away, but nature is already coming through, and there's both aspects can be seen. So I wrote an introduction to that book for them, and then they said to me, would you like to do another book? We're doing a series about place. Just pick any place you like. I think they imagine I'm picking Beckton Alp or, you know, something down the Thames Estuary, Isle of Grain, and I don't know out of where particularly, but suddenly I did think of this carboniferous limestone pavement area, very savage, very primal, where I'd grown up in South Wales. There was a stretch of coastland in the Gower Peninsula between Port Einan and Rhosyllia that I'd walked three significant times in my life, but I'd never got into this cave. There's a cave there, which I think of as a sort of cave of origin of everything, because it's the oldest ritual human burial in the British Isles. It's like 36,000 years old. And I knew of it being there, but I'd never actually found it. And I felt there was a story to be got out of teasing out a history, backstory for myself, and also trying to find a way to get into this cave and see what would happen. Because in a sense, I'd been travelling around it. But also, weirdly, this idea of the arches underneath the railway become almost a cave system. Partly because Andrew Cotting is trying to get off the ground a film about caves, because he did a trilogy of, starting with Filthy Earth, a fictional trilogy which was mud, dirt, Dudley Foster with no teeth, absolutely the soil. And then he did a second book, a film called Ivel, which was about a kid who escapes up into the trees and stays up in the trees. Now he wanted to go into the underground, so he's thinking about the underground. And I began to see those at railway arches as a cave system that ran right round London. And it was only logical, in a sense, to go to the ultimate cave, which was still there in my past, beyond it. So the two things, well, they don't obviously connect. There is a sort of symbolic connection between the two.
We'll finish up back at that cave in a while. But let's talk about, well, as you mentioned, you grew up in Wales. You spent childhood holidays there. So let's talk about that, you know, some memories of those first holidays.
Yeah, I spent a lot of very good holidays in a caravan that was on a farmer's field right on the edge of this bay, Port Einan Bay, but above a little village called Horton. And it had this spectacular view of this landscape and a great territory to explore in all sorts of ways. And also then it became the place where I first went to stay just with mates or something, like away from the family, so we're totally independent. We can create all those sort of teenage adventures that would occur. One of which becomes a walk to we don't know. I had no idea where we were going. I knew there was a cave after one headland, so we find that cave called Culverhole, which is walled up and mysterious, and you could crawl into it. And so there's all of that, and then it becomes a walk, and we meet these three girls, and we walk on to the end and just keep going and finish up in Rossilli without really knowing, because there was no Welsh coastal path, there were no maps or anything. So this is just a mysterious adventure, sort of Enid Blyton adventure for teenagers. And then the next time I came back with the artist Brian Cantley, it was much more projected, because I knew the landscape and I wanted to make photographs and drawings of it and gather up material for a show we had at the Whitechapel Gallery called Albion Island Vortex. Mm-hmm. So this was quite substantial, and there's a lot of material came out of it. But again, we didn't actually find this particular cave, the Pavilion Cave, because there's no signs to it, and we're clambering around all these headlands but don't identify the point where that is. And so there's a third walk when I'm 70-odd with my wife. I go back, but now there is a coast path and there's signs to everything, but there's no signs to that. And again, essentially there's too much to see and do, and you get to the end of it, oh, we've missed it again. So then I come back finally one more time and succeed.
I mean, I mentioned obviously you know you grew up in Wales and spent childhood holidays there, but in terms of writing about Wales, it's not, you know, it's obviously not your comfort zone. You have written about Wales before.
Yes, one book.
And got into a bit of trouble over it, really.
Well, it's a difficult book in a lot of ways. It was a book called Landor's Tower, and it wasn't sort of really about Wales. It was more about borders. It was the borderland of Wales, and it was also borderlands spinning off into Somerset. So it was like that fissure, the Bristol Channel, both sides of it. On the English side, there was a whole conspiracy business with Jeremy Thorpe, who was living down there and had clearly been involved in the attempted murder of a boyfriend, the shooting of a dog. Mm-hmm. All that stuff was floating about, and that tracked back into Wales. Some of the hitmen hired connected up Wales, so there was a mad conspiracy story on that side. And on the Welsh side, there was a lot of things about trying to set up utopian communities from people from outside coming in, taking over Clantony Priory and Abbey and the disasters that occurred when they tried to do that, right through from Walter Savage Landor through Eric Gill and David Jones to the hippie-ish communities, and Allen Ginsberg coming there and taking LSD. So there's a terrific, a lot of material to work with, but in a sense, the people had an expectation of me writing about London, didn't really engage with something that was happening out there that wasn't for them. And the people in Wales thought, why is he writing about Wales? What's his legitimacy to, what kind of bandwagon is he trying to jump on here? So there's an awkwardness about it.
And you upset people. Did you really get banned from the Hay Festival?
No, I didn't. I was rude about Hay because I thought the Hay Festival was pretty grisly and the whole business was fairly awful. And I used to go there quite a lot as a book dealer, so I knew the personalities. I don't think it actually upset anybody, because they used it in one of the quizzes in the future Hay Festival. So I think that was just a bit of PR somewhere.
There's an artist, Kerry Richards, that's an influence on this book, and indeed the title and the cover photo.
That's his picture that sort of started me off on it.
That one there up on the wall?
Yeah, on the wall there's a picture. It's based on a Dylan Thomas poem. It's a lithograph, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." And what it shows is a sprawled figure, a naked figure of a writer who is Dylan Thomas. And an owl is a sort of escaping with all the material that he's written, flying away with it. And there's the moon, a very stark black and white image. And it's got this curve like a stage, which is quite reminiscent of Francis Bacon. And in fact, Kerry Richards was somebody who encouraged Francis Bacon early on, who knew him quite well. So when I was starting off, and this is one of the things in the book, the first sort of paper or thesis or whatever I ever wrote was on Dylan Thomas, and I was researching that, and I saw this thing in an exhibition in Cardiff, and it was comparatively cheap, you know, and I could afford it. I bought it, and it's stayed with me ever since. But I've never resolved in any way of writing about it. And another series of paintings Kerry Richards had done were called around the Black Apple of Gower, which were mythological paintings of a circle, or almost like a cave, embedded within the rock, in which there are these male and female symbols, and in the rock are owls and fish and all kinds of other things. And I knew the work well, but I assumed this was just a generic, any old landscape with this stuff implanted in it, like a mandala. Well, then I realised now that this is very specific, that these are actual places in the Gower from Kerry Richards having lived at Pennard, very close to Vernon Watkins, poet, who was a friend of Dylan Thomas and who I had visited as a schoolboy in his bungalow on the clifftops there. And so all of that stuff came flooding back, and I wanted to understand how those two people made a powerful lifelong mythology of this small stretch of landscape, and how I'd kind of blundered into it without knowing any of that, but had still seen there was something I needed to think about and read about, including looking at these pictures for many years.
I'm Andrew Muller. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archive at littleatoms.com.
Is there, for you, an essential difference in writing about landscape in this sort of way to writing about like a place like Hackney, where there are multiple layers of...
It's very different. You know, the sense I got here was that if I'm writing about Hackney or London, where I've been writing about it since the early 1970s, I've laid down a lot of markers and memory deposits, like you would do on a sat nav or something. You can put wayside. Yeah. I've got those all over London. Any way I walk out of here, I've got things that seem, because I know them, to confirm my own identity. Mm-hmm. So here I am, legitimately a writer of the city, because I've written about this, or I've talked to so-and-so here, I've done this. Then you're in this stark, rocky landscape. There's none of that. And then I realise that the significance of the figure, the human figure in it, is negligible. And it's not a question of me recovering any sense of myself from it. It's much more to do with dissolving a sense of self and acknowledging the potency of this extraordinary place. So it's essentially, it becomes about place. It's the exact opposite of London. I could never make a place of London. It's, you know, it's a zillion lives, all thousands of writers. It's all of these echoes and words, any step you take. Mm-hmm. Out there, it's pared right down. There's next to nothing there. And these couple of people who've worked with it have equally come to this point. It's not about them, and it's not about the things they got from it. It's about making a kind of treaty whereby they can dissolve and just leave these traces that someone else can use to get them into the landscape rather than to get them into the people.
This imprint it seems to be firmly placing itself in this thing, the new nature, right?
Yes, it looks like that, but I mean, this is kind of pushing it a bit.
Sure.
It does obviously, Little Tower obviously do fit with a lot of the Robert McFarlane kind of new nature writing and writing about places like Silbury Hill. But the great advantage of working with someone like that is that they give so much attention to the look and feel of the object of the book and allow you to work with images and colour and texture in ways that don't happen when you work with a big mainstream publisher. I mean, they say you can't have colour, it's too expensive, we can't do it. They've done it, and they keep the book to a relatively modest price, and it proves that you can do it. So the feel was, for me, much more like the times when I had my own small press, and if I wanted to put this picture here, I'd put this picture here, and you have that extra level of freedom which I think probably affects the way it's written to some extent. It's kind of more free-flowing form.
Well, I raised the New Nature thing because, I mean, I don't know if you saw it a few weeks ago, Mark Cocker had a thing in the New Statesman, which was, I mean, basically moaning a bit about the New Nature writing.
And, well, it's become an industry.
Yeah.
Really.
And this idea that it's, you know, it's more, rather than people that know the countryside, it's city people coming and being awed by the countryside.
Well, I think there's also a format in it. A lot of it is about damaged people or troubled people or people, you know,
city people.
City people, not necessarily, not all city people, but they're people who've got some kind of trauma that somehow is healed by undertaking a journey, a quest, an engagement with nature.
Yeah, you're clearly describing Helen MacDonald's book there. Wonderful.
Well, there's various. Yeah, there's all kinds. You know, every one of them. I mean, Richard Mabey's books are about having a sort of mental crisis and you know, coming through. There's loads of people have lost a partner. There's a mourning book, or whatever, or they themselves have got some terminal illness. And there's all. It's a superimposition in which, you know, this thing I'm saying about, you know, the person's own identity is taken out into this to say, can we go somewhere beyond it? Can we make something else of ourselves? And my sense was literally, I want to go back to memory strands, but I want to dissolve it, and I want to also to slightly pay my due to a place that I haven't done justice to, you know, that meant a lot to me.
Ultimately, how does memory actually, more than, you know, your memory of those childhood holidays, and also the later but still a while ago walks that you did that you talk about in this book, how do all of those sort of play into the writer who wrote this book, did that walk the last time, if you see what I mean?
Well, I think the book starts with the arrival at the beginning of the project, and the first thing I had to do was sort of get into the sea, and it was a really unexpected, because go in the sea down in Hastings or Andrew Cotting, it's quite a lot, and it's a kind of, it's often full of sediment, or it's almost, you can smell the fish and chips, and it's kind of bracing, and this sea was felt peculiar, and it felt that it had a quality of dissolving time to some extent, that being out there, all the bits that didn't fit together when I was on the shore, I mean, I couldn't think where exactly this caravan had been or how we'd got on. Suddenly it all just whoosh, it all fitted. And it was also like one swim became all swims, and layers of images sort of floated to the surface. And strangely enough, shortly after this friend of mine I hadn't seen in God knows how many years, out of the blue, sends a...
Who had been on one of the walks with you.
Yeah, you know, first walk when he used to stay in this caravan, sends this childhood photograph of herself that I don't recognise at all, but yet, you know, here we are, I know that's my next-door neighbour. I mean, things come back that you'd had no idea of, and I think the sea was that process that somehow churned up this kind of imagery.
So we're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to get back to that cave, and particularly you talk about, one of the characters you talk about in this book is... fantastic man, paleontologist Richard Buckland.
William Buckland, yeah. Episode of the cave was so bizarre in that I try to get to it, and you come to a dead end, I'm crawling around the cliff, and then suddenly this woman appears out of nowhere, like a kind of white witch, and she says, I'm going to the cave, follow her down a chasm with rocky pools, and get it. So finally, after all these years, I'm in the cave. And it happens that she knows a lot about it, and she's married to Roland Hutton, who writes about pagan Britain, which she's connected to. And she invokes the presence of this person, William Buckland, who was an Oxford academic, who in 1820s is summoned down there. He doesn't find it, but he's called there by local people who found it. And they ransack this thing, and they pull out these bones, and you see it as a major raid on it. And it becomes his story, and he carries it all away, and it's in Oxford, in the University Museum, whereas I thought the bones were in Swansea. There are a collection in Swansea, but those are replicas, they're fakes, they look dusty, they look real. And then Buckland himself, of course, is completely insane. I mean, he starts to eat his way through the evolutionary ladder. He eats rhinoceroses, horses, lizards, flies, bees, the lot. It just does it. And finally, at Newnham House outside Oxford, when they show him this relic, the the heart, supposedly, of Louis XIV, as the great treasure of the house, in a silver casket. He opens it up and he gobs it down and swallows it like an oyster. And I thought, this is amazing. This is just so ridiculous and absurd, but it's a perfect metaphor for the kind of outsider, including myself, who comes into these spaces and insists on their version of the story. And I thought that was very significant.
One final question then. So what next? Is it back to the city?
Well, I would like to work on a London book, not a sequel to any of these, but a one that deals with this moment, because I think we're in this very interesting limbo between cities. I think it's the last of a certain kind of London, and the new has not emerged or defined itself exactly yet. And while that process is happening, I think there's something quite interesting to be described, and I'd like to make it a kind of last book in this long series of books I've been doing, to find out what the city is and also to find out what I am.
I've been talking to Ian Sinclair. We've been talking about his recent books, London Overground, A Day's Walk Around the Ginger Lion, which is out now from Hamish Hamilton, and Black Apples of Gower, which is out now from Little Toller. Ian, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about the two of them.
Thanks again. Come back in 5 years.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.